Where do you go when you die?
Good.
Actor Tim Robbins got a glimpse in this cult classic, Jacob's Ladder. And I guess that's how it is with the afterlife. I mean, we know it's probably going to work out okay, but... what if it doesn't? So we keep asking the questions. We keep looking for the answers. And once in a while, we come across some people who really seem to know.
There are no devils in hell. There are just human beings who have evil thoughts and habits. And then, as Richard mentioned, there are some kind of thought forms which are formed by people producing those evil and murderers and that kind of thoughts, and they have so much power that they exist there for some time. And if a person has kind of affinity harboring those negative feelings and thoughts throughout the life, or at least to some extent, then it might be that this is somehow attracting to these lower levels of afterlife. And I find it interesting that negative near-death experiences, they tend to reveal that these stages are felt by people who go briefly to the other side, so to speak.
That's today's guest, Dr. Ante Sevanayan, who's written a new book about the Finnish mystic Pekka Ervast, who back in the 1890s had a series of amazing mystical experiences that revealed to him what really happens after we die. It's a very interesting book, in particular because it has so much overlap with the modern-day near-death experience research that we've focused so much upon. And yet, at the same time, it raises some of the same questions that we always come back to regarding science and materialism and our need to try and know and understand this topic from reason, and at the same time, our appreciation for the fact that we know, deep down, that reason can't really get us there. In this interview, we're also joined by the very excellent biblical scholar and spiritual scholar Richard Smalley, who wrote the introduction for this book, so it was great having him on as well. Before we get started with the interview, let me just mention that Ante has informed me that the book is available actually right now as a free ebook. It's an excellent book. I've read it. It's nicely formatted. It's not like a cheap freebie throwaway kind of thing. Well researched, again, with an excellent introduction by Richard Smalley. It's just a great book that's available for free. So that's kind of a cool thing. And I'll, of course, have the links to that in the show notes. This was a fun interview for me. We talk about all sorts of topics, all the way from the idiosyncratic nature of these mystical experiences and how much are we to trust my big toe kind of simulation theory kind of things versus a total full-blown spiritual or even Christian mystical experience. We talk about backdoor materialism and medicine in particular, and whether a proposed head transplant that's supposed to happen in 2018 will reveal anything more about how we might understand consciousness. And then we even venture off into biblical scholarship and biblical studies just a little bit, because when you have a chance to talk to Richard Smalley, you can't miss the opportunity to talk about that stuff as well. So don't let this creepy music and creepy introduction freak you out too much. It's really kind of an upbeat and fun interview. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you stick around for this episode of Skeptico. Today we welcome two guests to Skeptico, Dr. Ante Sevanayan. He joins us as someone who's contacted me because he's listened to Skeptico, and then I came to find that he was writing a very interesting book right up our alley. The book is titled From Death to Rebirth, and it's about the Finnish mystic Pekka Ervist. And now before I go further, how do we really say that name?
Pekka Ervast.
Ah, good enough. Okay, good. He was a Finnish mystic, a Christian mystic back in the late 1890s. So we're going to talk about that book. We're also going to talk more in general about mysticism and in particular Christian mysticism. And we're also joined by the very excellent spiritual scholar that many of you will be aware of, that is Richard Smalley. His work I've referenced several times on this show because it's so excellent, so extraordinary, and many, many people regard it very highly. Richard is the author of several books. One that you may be aware of is his most recent, How God Became God. So, Richard, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, like I was explaining, Auntie Richard, I thought what we would do is talk about this book, but really kind of talk around it and talk about some of the interesting topics that I think it connects to. We have the near-death experience, science that the show has spent a lot of time covering, and this book connects to that because here we have this guy back in the 1890s, and he's saying, hey, I went through this very tough spiritual transformative experience, but at the end, I know all about what happens in the after-death world, and let me tell you about it. We also have it connecting just with mysticism in general, with theosophy, with a lot of topics that I think listeners might find interesting. Where I thought we might start, though, is just with this basic idea. And Auntie, you can either tackle this, or Richard, I know this is really in your swing zone as well. You know, theosophy is something that I think throws people for a loop. I know it throws me for a loop. I think there's a strong historical connection we have to the word that I don't think fits with the way people use it and think about it today. So how do we want to just pull that apart to begin with as a definitional kind of foundational thing?
Well, I can start. Theosophy means divine wisdom in its Greek roots. It has two meanings, one of which is generic. And that small t theosophy is, shall we say, a kind of blueprint of the structure of the divine. Works that have been called theosophical in this sense include the Zohar, the Kabbalistic work from the medieval era, and the works of Jakob Böhme, a 17th century German mystic. Now, theosophy in a more restricted sense refers to the ideas propagated by H.P. Blavatsky in the late 19th century and incorporated in the Theosophical Society. So that is theosophy with a capital T. To put it in an even broader context, there is something called variously the ancient wisdom, the esoteric tradition, the perennial philosophy. This is universal. All versions of it are not identical, all versions of it are not identical. That is actually correct. But overall, the similarities are greater than the differences. Theosophy, in the capital T sense, happens to be a formulation of this particular ancient wisdom in the language and spirit of the late 19th century and spoke very much to the needs of its time. And as a movement, it brought forth a lot of things, including the New Age as we know it. It opened the door for Eastern religions to come into the West, among other things.
And that's where it gets tricky for me. And Auntie, maybe you want to pick up here and talk about what theosophy meant to Pekka. And in particular, one of the things I found interesting is he's struggling with some very real kind of political struggles that, you know, we can probably understand in the context of today's kind of religious battles or new religious movements that get started. And so all of a sudden we take what Richard was just saying, which sounds great, and there's this perennial wisdom and there's all this stuff. And then we hear about these guys fighting and the big breakups and all that stuff, which I think is also on the back of our mind too. So maybe switch gears for a minute and say what theosophy felt like to P.E. back in the 1890s from what we can tell from what he's written.
Yes. So I think that he was at about 18 years old when he encountered the first theosophical book, and it really changed his life, because if he was looking for truth from the very early on, and he wanted to know if there is knowledge about what is the meaning of life and how should we live our lives. He wasn't that interested in the afterlife or what happens after we die, or is there even life after death. He was interested in how to solve problems between human beings in a humane way. And then he found theosophy. It was Sinnett's book, and he really felt that now he found something important. And later on, because practically every Finn was Christian at the time, he was raised in Christian culture as well. I don't know how much that has an impact on it, but he felt that Christianity, in its esoteric meaning, not in a religious or a church meaning, it had a lot to offer for him, because he found some consolation from some words in the Bible which made him believe that there is truth and he can personally find it. And he found that these ideas about ethics of Christianity from Leo Tolstoy, the great author, Russian author, who really changed his life in a different for a different direction after finding these kind of commandments, Jesus' commandments, that they eventually led him into transformation experience, in which he felt that he got a contact with his, I would put it, higher self, and he felt that in that experience, it was a light experience, which actually resembles quite a lot of what NDE people are telling us, and he felt that these commandments which Tolstoy had revealed from the New Testament, they were not invented by Jesus or any God. They were imprinted in the invisible cosmos in itself. They were the laws of life itself. So in a way, that was the start of his real spiritual teaching and his path in Finnish theosophy.
Excellent. And I think even if we were to stop and pause right there for a second, there's already some really interesting stuff to pull apart. And I turn to you, Richard, and say, how are we to understand the mystic, in particular in our modern day culture? I mean, I think this is right up your alley in terms of some of the books that you've written and trying to understand what we call spirituality now, which encompasses this mystical kind of experience. But then also, how are we to understand the Christian mystic in particular? And Antti just, kind of blew past that point, but I think it's a very interesting one, is that he was immersed in a Christian culture. You almost get the sense from reading him that he really couldn't even consider anything outside of that. So his mysticism is decidedly Christian at the same time, I think, as Antti is suggesting. It was broader than maybe what most people would associate with kind of a strict or fundamentalist kind of Christian experience that people, as they understand it today. Do you get what I'm saying? Can you maybe help me out there, pull that apart for me?
Yeah, well, the first question is, how do we deal with mystical experience or mysticism in life today? I'll give you a one-word answer, which is phenomenologically. That is to say, if someone says they had a given experience, it's usually a good idea to believe that they had this experience. There are frauds and, you know, so on, but a lot of people do actually have mystical experience. And that has to be taken at face value. That cannot be summarily dismissed as just illusion, just imagination, that sort of thing. Because, frankly, your whole cognition is illusion and imagination. So that doesn't help too much. So I think it has to be taken phenomenologically with an open mind that is both open to criticism and open to acceptance, which in this day is very hard to do because it's always this or that. There's a certain level of the mind that only can count up to two, as Uspensky could say, you know, us and them, Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, blah, blah, blah. You have to get past that to understand mystical experience. Now, the second half had to do with Christianity. And I'll say this. I did say previously that there was this universal tradition that appears over and over and over again in any number of times and places. And it has been expressed in different languages. I mean, spiritual languages, not verbal languages. Christianity is one of these. It's not the only one. And I would not even argue that it is the best or privileged over all the others. For us today, this is the Christian, shall we say, operating system is installed in our brains. If you don't believe in God, it's the Christian God you don't believe in short. So we have to face it and deal with it. What I'm suggesting, and what I suggested particularly in my book, Inner Christianity, is that let's at least understand this ancient wisdom using the language of Christianity, because it makes it easier to understand, and B, it will help us reconcile ourselves to many of the problems we have with Christianity, the vast majority of which are entirely justified.
Can I add a little bit about for the excellent words that Richard that spoke about B's case? He was early on well-versed with languages. He was about 5 or 6 years old when he learned to read French before he learned to read his own native language, which was Swedish. And he knew something like 10 languages or so. He studied Sanskrit at university so he could read original sources. So he was very enthusiastic about reading the Eastern religions as well. And he really, really highly admired and even loved great religions, Buddha, and all the great teachings of yogis and all that. So he wasn't exclusively Christian at all. And the main point here is to make a difference between Christ or Christ consciousness and Jesus. Jesus was a man who was fully immersed in that Christ consciousness in his life. But Christ consciousness is not for only one person. It's shared by all living beings, basically. And you might say God or whatever language you prefer, or you Buddhist might say that it's the Buddha nature you are attached to or aspiring to reach or whatever. So Christ, in this sense, really transcends Christianity. And it's, one might say even that it's this consciousness which is searched for in all mystic traditions in one respect. I don't know if Richard agrees with this, but that's my interpretation of this.
Let's say that's awesome. I mean, that is to me. I've been saying that for a long time in the show. But it's also, you know, rather than an end point or a pushback point or something to kind of rally our arms about against the materialistic, atheistic kind of pushback that we get, I almost see it as another direction, because this materialistic atheism, I think, is waning, is really been, for the most part, supplanted by people who've really looked at it and examined it. I say it's a jumping off point. It's the starting point for what we might consider is next. And as part of that, I guess I jump into, again, talking about PE, and I throw out a word here, idiosyncratic, because that's the word that keeps coming back to me again. Let me, if I can, tell you guys a story, digress a little bit, a skeptical story. This was years ago, being probably 6-7 years ago. I was embattled in this kind of ongoing debate with a group of skeptics that produce a very popular podcast show. And the guy is from Yale. His name is Dr. Stephen Novella, and he's quite well known, quite prominent in both the scientific and in this atheistic community. And the nature of this debate, which turned into a demonstration, was on mediumship. And I said, well, this is just, it's been proven in the lab, you know, over and over again. And it's the reality for many, many people who've had these encounters with, there's no better way to say it, deceased, people who are deceased, consciousness that is beyond the physical form. So I contacted a woman, and her name is Marilyn Hughes. And Marilyn's a very interesting woman. I talked to her and she goes, you know, I don't really do mediumship readings. She goes, what I do is out-of-body travel. Now, this is right along the lines of PE, and that's why I bring it up. Marilyn is a devout Catholic, but she has some very, for a lot of Catholics, she has a lot of ideas that maybe wouldn't jive with their Catholic upbringing. But the importance of the story for me is we actually did a demonstration where I contacted, had a volunteer of a woman who had tragically lost her teenage daughter to suicide. And Marilyn said, well, let me see what I can do. And Marilyn then went and, according to her, ventured into the after-death state, found her daughter, and brought back a bunch of information that was, one, confirming of the fact that she, for lack of a better term, lack of a better word, had traveled to these other dimensions. She brought back this information that I think to any reasonable person who was listening to the show would say, gee, there's no way someone could know that stuff. But more importantly, it seemed to be extremely healing and meaningful to the mother who had lost this daughter. Now, the reason that I say that whole story is because it does kind of have this intersection of science, spirituality, mysticism that says, hey, here's someone who's having a mystical experience, this out-of-body experience, which if you push it is extremely idiosyncratic. I mean, there's a lot of details to her experience that would be in conflict or would appear to be in conflict with what P.E. is saying or with what Tom Campbell is saying. If anyone knows Tom Campbell from the Monroe Institute, author of My Big Toe, who has a very simulation, has also traveled to these other realms, but has a very techno simulation kind of view of it. Again, idiosyncratic. If we jump over to the near-death experience accounts, again, extremely idiosyncratic. One person's reporting one thing, one person's reporting another. So I've laid a lot on the table there, but maybe we can approach this idea of, as we put our arms around this, what are we to make of what seems to be the differences of these very real, as you pointed out, Richard, you know, we can't just blow past them and say, well, it doesn't matter because they're all illusion anyway. There seems to be some reality to them, but there seems to be some differences almost bordering on contradictions to them. And I'd like you both maybe to talk about that.
Well, what I would say is this. Let's say you don't believe in the existence of Africa. You just don't believe in the existence of it. You want proof. So there are all these descriptions of Africa, ranging from the Sahara to the pyramids, to the source of the Nile, to the Congo, to South Africa. And all of these things seem very idiosyncratic. They all seem so different. How could they be true? How could all of these descriptions be true? They're all talking about Africa. All we can really conclude is that these people who are talking about Africa are just making it up in all their imaginations, or, you know, it's an illusion. My point is that if the afterlife, if it exists, if these other realms exist, we have every reason to believe that they are at least as multivaried and disparate in nature as the perfectly earthly continent of Africa. So you can make a lot of idiosyncrasies, but I think it would be foolish to expect every last report to be the same.
Right, but hold on, let me interject, because that's all well and good, but if one person comes back and says the Nile runs north, and the other person says the Nile runs south, I mean, we have something there that we can't just say, well, wow, isn't that interesting? Everybody kind of sees the world differently. It's like, no, there's no way to really resolve that.
May I say something here?
Yes.
So I really like that Richard's analogy. It seems to be appropriate. But first, let me make a point about science. Different people have a little bit different experiences. Not all people who go through the NDA do not have the same faces. They have partial faces, and they have different types of experiences. That's where we need science. When we gather a long database, a large database, and that when if you use strict scientific rigorous designs like Pinman-Lommel study and some others are, which are the best we can have in medicine, for instance. And then we know what is the big picture in these cases. And then we can discern different phases, and then we can start counting how many reaches different phases and so forth. You are well versed with this. But my point is that you can't really know if you just listen to one person or 10 persons. You need to have a rigorous scientific study and many of them. And when you have many of them, then you have a scientific map. That's how I think scientific method works. Not one single study, but many studies supporting each other eventually. Then we know something about it. And that's how we know, despite of differences between individuals, that's how we know the big picture, what's going on. And what is interesting to me is that when I've been interested in various accounts of afterlife for many, many years, spiritualistic and theosophical and many others, and kind of looking at what they say about it. And well, now I'm speaking for the book. When I've compared this, what PE had to say about this afterlife stages, early stages especially, and when I compare what this big picture emerging from the NDE study tells, they seem to match almost perfectly. Not perfectly, but extremely well, might say. There are minor differences, but if you take a look at the leaving the body, looking at your surroundings, going to the light, meeting the relatives and deceased and perhaps some holy being, and then seeing your life review, it's all there. There might be some differences when the life review, for instance, takes place in theosophical accounts, and in Eros view, it takes place at least shortly after you leave your body. In many NDE cases, it takes place in the light, but in some cases, it does take place when you leave the body. So that kind of differences might be there. But what is interesting is that P is not the only one to tell about these phases. So you really can't just have a couple of cases and then kind of try to guess what's going on. But when you have the scientific studies, which are reliable enough, and then you take a look at these esoteric or occult people who are saying, and then you compare them, you'll find something which is amazingly good match, I'd say.
Richard, would you like to add anything there?
There are certainly differences in state, but I'd like to know what science is. Science is, or ideally, some kind of discipline that we're told considers all the relevant data. But skeptical materialism does not do that. What it does is bracket all things that it counts as paranormal, that is somehow out of sync with, say, the way an eighth grader who's just learned Newton's laws of physics would describe the world. And you've bracketed that all. It's imaginary because it's not scientific. Well, this is part of the data. This is the human experience that goes so universally, so far back, has to be counted as part of the data to begin with. If you dismiss it a priori as unscientific because it is not of the material world, it does not accord with our preconceptions, as the typical skeptic does, you, my friend, are begging the question. And that is what I see a lot of in what is proudly calls itself scientific materialism.
Well, let me just interject because none of us know each other, but a couple of years ago, I wrote a book, Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. And the basic premise of the book was science has fundamentally flubbed consciousness. And if you get consciousness wrong, then you really can't get anything right. And to further that point, maybe is that I think we've known for at least 100 years, science has known by scientific means that we can't really measure things. So that's what quantum physics has come back and told us at the end of the day. Hey, we can kind of approximate here, but we're not really measuring in quite the way that we thought we were. So I guess I'm with you on that. One of my concerns, and Antia brought this up to you a little bit, is that as much as we try and get away from scientific materialism, and then we put it over and we want to hold it up and say, no, you don't understand. Science is a method. It's not a position statement, which I totally agree with. At the same time, we want to pull it back in. We have this desire for backdoor materialism, I call it, where we want to say, oh yeah, but look at this study where we showed that NDEers have this kind of experience 42.6% of the time, and we want to somehow hold on to that and give that meaning and elevate that up in a way that, again, tries to add some kind of scientific legitimacy to it that I don't know. I mean, I feel torn with that because I understand the appeal of that, and I certainly do as someone who likes to be logical, likes to be rational, but I also see the limits of that. And let me throw one tiny more piece on the table there, and that's that I was surprised to find this same kind of what I call spiritual physics in the work of P.E. again. Here he's writing in the, you know, 1890s, and he's saying, well, suicide works like this, and it can be broken down these ways. And we spend this much time here and this much time there in the afterlife. And again, I wanted to challenge that and say, why do we want to reduce this down to some kind of physics again, like we understand it, we can measure it, we understand time. Time is linear. Well, we clearly, maybe it wasn't commonly understood in 1890, but it certainly is today that this concept of time and this linearity to it is just a convenience that makes us comfortable with what we experience, but doesn't have any reality to it. So what about that?
Well, let me first say something about science. I'm a science teacher, physics teacher, and I'm enthusiastic about it. And I've produced some science myself, and so I have an idea how science works. And of course, listening to your skeptical shows have allowed me to see a different perspective. So what I find interesting in this NDE studies and children who claim to remember their past lives and some psi research is that using the scientific method or scientific methods which do not assume any metaphysical assumptions about soul or anything else but material world and energy and information. That's the package, basically. So that's fine. I have no trouble with that. As a physics teacher, I know that these laws of physics, they work well in lab, and you can reproduce them. And the better lab you have, the better you can reproduce them. So there's no problem in that. However, when these topics I just mentioned, when they are investigated using scientific methods, you end up with the data which is not anymore best explained by reducing all these concepts within the materialistic framework. But you need to look at the data, and then you are forced to have a different explanation, which opens the door to other things besides material world. I think this is what skeptical shows and research have very clearly shown. And I find it fascinating that using the scientific method, you just end up with something which isn't anymore within the realm of scientific method for those who believe in natural axiom that there can be no other explanations besides natural ones, and natural defined in a narrow sense.
Yes, let me just emphasize that point because I think it's an awesome one, is that I think the greatest contribution science has made is to obsolete itself and to show.
At least that one assumption, which is well, skeptics, they really want to believe in that. There can be nothing else. Of course, it depends on skeptic you talk to, but that's what they seem to be adhering to very strongly, that there can't be any other things besides what you can find in natural world. So in a way, you're right. Yeah.
Richard, can you jump in there?
I would myself say that there's a great deal of evidence that is not only scientific, but to use a bad word that I hope you don't mind, I use on a show like this, but anecdotal. Nevertheless, I think there's something to be said for the existence of these alternate planes and the survival of the human entity on them at some way after death. But I agree with you about a lot of it, where it says, you know, like, well, this is how long you stay on X plane if you commit suicide and that kind of thing. I simply don't know about, and I'm not wildly inclined to take it at face value.
Well, Richard, let me pull you back, because I know I talked for a long time. What do you make of this, what I'm calling backdoor materialism? And I'll tell you where it really comes into play. If you are familiar with the work of Thomas Campbell, My Big Toe, he's very popular on YouTube and on the lecture circuit. Monroe Institute, if anyone knows, would give you an idea. But what I see coming from that is even a further pullback of the mystic. So he's in the mystical realm, but he's saying, oh, no, it's a simulation. Like, and think of it as a computer simulation. And I've done the math. I've done the physics. It's a 60 frames a second simulation. I mean, there is a continuum of mystical experiences that get slotted into some very materialistic sounding expressions of this that I want to say concern me, give me pause. I mean, I don't agree with. I mean, I don't know. Backdoor materialism. What do you make of that?
I'm not familiar with Campbell's work at all, so I don't really feel qualified to comment on it. I think that even if you go that way, you can say, well, it's all a simulation. It's all, a simulacrum constructed by the mind. Well, that's true, no doubt, but I think cognitive science has proven that your ordinary sensory and cognitive experience is also a simulacrum that is constructed by your nervous system. So to privilege one and say, well, this is real, and to turn this other aside and say this is false, I think is fallacious arguing. But that particular argument that you're talking about of Campbell's, I don't know enough about to comment on.
There's a perspective to put here. Well, if I'm referring to P.E.'s work, he tells that, it's not his own opinion. Of course, there are many others who say the same thing, that the afterlife states is just a very, very tiny fraction of the other planes or other worlds that exist there. And usually when somebody leaves his or her body, they will end up in that different realm, but not in the realm where the dead people are residing. So it's kind of, in P.E.'s words, it's sacred, it's guarded in a sense, and you can't enter in that world without good cause. So that might explain some of the differences you just mentioned, that people go to this vastly greater world, which is called the astral world in the theosophical language, and some other people are using that as well. And then there is this tiny, tiny kind of area, which is the land of the dead or the Blue Island or whatever you want to call it. And
yeah, but Auntie, go read, like I'm saying, Tom Campbell, or go read Robert Monroe, Monroe Institute. Those guys, I mean, one, their process, they're very rigorous scientifically how they did it, 50, 60 years ago, and they're still doing it today. You can go to Virginia and you can sit down and attend a weekend and they'll give you the hemisync things and you put on your head and you'll have the out-of-body experience. But they've mapped it all out too. That's my point. So I think they call it like room. You know, you go to room 9 or level 7. I mean, they have all this elaborate system of mapping out all these realms too. So again, you would probably find similarities to P.E.'s mapping, but you'd also find differences. And then if you go back to Marilyn Hughes, like I said, I mean, she also produced and was featured in a documentary on Armageddon. And she's very convinced, again, devout Catholic, and someone I, if you want to say tested and found her to be effective at what she can do in terms of out of body. But, you know, she's predicting Armageddon and that passed. Her date that she said it was going to happen, that passed. But, you know, that changes all the stuff that drives people nuts about those crazy mystics again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about Jürgen Ziebe. You had him in the show some years ago, and I read his books, and it seems to me that what he is describing about the afterlife states, it coheres quite well what P.E. is saying, for instance. And he even told that he had guidance to begin with. He met this person, I'm not sure if he called him a master or some exalted being who was really, really kind of familiar with all these states that were going on, and he helped him to move between different phases and states. So he got guidance, and this is explained in P.E.'s book as well, how this is organized in a way. So I found it fascinating that Ziebe, who had nothing to do with theosophy to begin with, even though he's aware that it exists, his experiences match well in this regard with what P.E. is saying. So it depends. If you go unprepared, you might see very different things. If you are prepared and kind of, you might say, purified or having these mystical experiences. And I found Ziebe's work quite impressive in that respect.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Richard.
Well, let me just say briefly, you know, for one thing, let us assume that there are these alternate realities. They are necessarily not earthly reality, right? But our cognition is totally shaped by our experience of earthly reality. It is impossible, for example, just try to visualize a color you've never seen. I find that impossible. So what you're doing is taking, arguably, these experiences of alternate realities and framing them in the language of this reality. And there are bound to be differences, even apparent contradictions. I myself would not privilege any one of these accounts radically over the others, whether it's Robert Munro's or Swedenborg's or anyone else's. So I think those things taken into account, I think they're pointing to something. Let's not be too 100% certain that we know XYZ about exactly how it is.
I love that. Let's take that big caution sign and make sure we pull it out on each other all the time when we need it, and to others too, because I think you're so right. I mean, even if we just kind of, again, try and use our rational, logical mind, I think you've hit on a key part of that, and that is our human cognitive processes as we understand them are filtering all this stuff, right? So it's all contaminated by our filter. And as soon as we realize that, we kind of throw up our hands and say, okay, well, we can play this consensus reality game where you're talking and I'm pretending I understand you, and I'm talking and you pretend you're understanding me. And it's a useful, fun game, and maybe we'll feel better. But at the end of the day, there's all these filters going on. So I love that. Look, let me, if I can, switch gears and try and touch on a couple other things tangential, but I think very interesting. Richard, you wrote a very excellent introduction to this book, From Death to Rebirth, a book about this Finnish mystic, Pekka Ervast, and it was co-authored by our guest, Antti, and a couple of other folks as well. And you're going to want to check it out. It's really, let me say that because I've kind of been interested in talking about these other topics. It is a fascinating read. It is stunning in a lot of ways to be reading these words from 100 years ago that do seem so relevant, do seem so pertinent, do seem so connected with a modern NDE account that you might read today, or a modern mystical experience. And that in and of itself is something we could really explore and pull apart. But I'm going to move on a little bit, because I'll have all the links, and people should definitely check out the book, and I encourage you to do so. But back to this introduction that you wrote, Richard, there was a couple things in there that I thought they just kind of piqued my interest. One thing I wanted to talk about is this this myth of progress or non-myth of progress, if you don't think progress is a myth. I hear this all the time. The veil is thinning. We are more of in a consciousness world, evolved consciousness world. I'm not so sure. In particular, as we're just talking about, how has the veil thinned? How do we know that the veil has thinned or we've made this progress? When we do look at the work of PE and we say, you know, how have we really progressed?
I'm not entirely sure we have. And I'm not sure that I believe in the myth of progress. And that myth is being questioned now. Because in one sense, we've enjoyed a lot of progress. We live in absurd luxury compared even to the aristocrats of 200 years ago. I mean, talking about an ordinary middle-class American person. In that sense, there's been progress. There's also been progress in things like environmental degradation, weapons of mass destruction, to use a phrase used by somebody or another. So does this all add up to progress? I don't know. I do know that as the Christian worldview was losing its hold during the Enlightenment, it rapidly became supplanted, in the early 19th century, say, with the Whig notion of history, which was all about progress. So the, shall we say, eschatology of Christ coming down, fixing all things at the time of the end, was starting to weaken. So we had to replace it with a myth of gradually incremental improvements or dramatic improvements in progress. Now, a lot of the New Age has taken that into this, in a sense, spiritualized it by saying, yeah, we're just about to enter into a brilliant, you know, new era and everybody's awakening. I don't know that that's the case at all. When I first became interested in a lot of things, you know, in the 1980s, the New Age movement was at its height, and it was a lot more possible to believe that. But 30 years later, it's a lot more ambiguous, especially since, well, all right, a smartphone is a great improvement in a lot of ways. But in some ways, it also seems to be like dulling people's intelligence and making them more isolated. So I myself do not necessarily believe that. So it's not a view that I'm really willing to defend. It may be so. It may not be so.
What I took out of your introduction that I thought was very interesting and worth bringing up and talking about, because I agree, you kind of suggested that medicine and the technological advancements in medicine might be the wedge that kind of furthers our understanding of what progress means and whether progress is a myth. And I think that's that brings it to a reality. And I think I sent you a link to this Italian doctor that some people have probably heard about, who is very renowned and very qualified and is talking about doing a head transplantation in 2018. And I think, to me, that really cuts to the core, if you will, of some of these ideas about transhumanism and how that might intersect with our ideas about what it is to be a spiritual being and the transcendence of the spiritual experience. So maybe both of you want to talk about what some of these technological advances what might mean and how they might challenge. You know, we've been here for almost an hour talking about all these cool things. What about when the technology comes along and says, oh, no problem, I can move your soul from this entity to this entity? Is that going to be the wedge that now causes us to have to re-examine all these great ideas we have?
Can I make a comment off the earlier point about thinning the veil first? So I think that if you take a look at a larger perspective, which Richard nicely brought up, is that, say, 300, 400 years ago, if you spoke about reincarnation or out-of-body experiences, you were in serious trouble in many parts in Europe. You are not anymore. And actually, these ideas, which we take so self-evident that you can talk about these things, and you know many people, lay people know, who have nothing to do with religions or or Theosophy or any spiritual movements, they know about these things a little bit at least. So it's
in
the
culture.
But isn't
that kind of a cultural thing? I mean, you're talking about the West. You're talking about the Europeans who are the only people throughout time, throughout history, the only group that's gone away from, right? All the shaman and all the people in.
That's true. But there is some progress if you think in terms of hundreds of years, what you can talk about, what you can write, and we can have even this conversation with no fear. I mean, it wasn't possible in the 16th century, say.
Yeah, we all know that. But Auntie, what are we going to do when this guy takes the head off of one guy and puts it on another guy?
Yeah,
I mean, that's going to answer a lot of questions. We might be having a very different conversation next year.
Let me make a confession here. I'm a part-time skeptic. It means that when we're dealing with questions which are in the realm of science, I'm always looking for the best evidence, as you as well. But what I'm looking for not one study, but many studies, replication, independent replications, and then I'm looking at the whole picture, which is meta-analysis or reviews or something like that, and then we know quite certain. So what I'm saying about that experiment, I took a look at it. I'll wait and see. And after a couple of years and after replications and many, many rounds, then we know what is the data that we can trust. And then I can make my conclusions about it. So even if it happens once, it's not something which would be scientifically that, revolutionary, unless it's replicated, as you know. So I'm a bit, I hesitate to say, a bit skeptical about it.
I'm not a scientist, and that's largely because I'm skeptical, some of the fundamental premises of science. But, all right, you're talking about you can transplant consciousness technologically. Okay, let's go with that. What if you go back to the year 1750 and two learned scientific savants are talking about whether it would be possible to land a man on the moon? One of them says it is. One of them says it will never happen. Which one was right? Well, the answer is obvious. But here's the catch. What the increase in knowledge required to put a man on the moon took science far beyond what the knowledge of its day of 1750 was. So if you are actually going to get to a point where you're transplanting consciousness in reality rather than speculatively and, Arthur C. Clarke land, you may have to know a great deal more about consciousness than they do now. As you know, even getting a coherent definition of consciousness has been rather difficult to extract from the experts.
True. Here's where I was going, guys. And again, I apologize for not having the exact line or the exact quote from your introduction. But what I thought was a great point was that, we can talk about these things philosophically, but technology, that's the advantage of technology in particular. And if we want to make a distinction between technology and engineering and science, which I think is a useful distinction sometimes to make, a lot of people don't understand science, but they'll point to their frickin' iPhone and say, see this iPhone 8? Let me show you what it can do. And we can't deny what it can do. And medicine is even trickier, right? So when we do, the CRISPR gene therapy and we're rewiring and we're changing genes, or even something as kind of commonplace in terms of our understanding about neuroplasticity and our ability of the brain to rewire itself. I think you were correct, Richard, to point to medicine in particular and the technology of medicine as being kind of the tip of the spear in some ways in terms of getting at some of these questions. And I just said I would just take that one step further and say, here's a spear that seems to be poking out, and that is this guy's doing a freaking head transplant. And I don't know what's going to happen, and I don't know how I'm going to feel about what happens. And I don't think it's going to be anything clear in, like you're saying, Auntie, but this is not the kind of thing where we're going to need 5 or 6 studies. I mean, we're going to have somebody who used to have a head and now has a different head, and that's going to answer some questions right away.
Yeah, I think that medicine is indeed a key here, because without medicine, we wouldn't have NDE results as we know them. And they have produced many techniques which allow us to study these phenomena, even if the researcher doesn't believe in any metaphysical explanation of it. He or she might end up with having the data which suggests that the mind doesn't equal the brain, as you tend to say here in Skeptical, the Unskeptical. So I think that medicine will play and is playing an important role of changing people's mind. For instance, Richard talks about in his excellent introduction to the book about Eben Alexander and his experiences. And when these are coming into public view, and many, many people, at least in the West, they get to know about these special cases and perhaps even scientific research in general in this field, it might change their minds at least a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think it's true. Medicine has pushed the boundaries back a little bit. But all of this, to go back to your example of the head transplant, these hypothetical things, and, you know, let's say it's done. Okay. There's kind of an assumption that we know what's going to happen once it's done, that if you transplant someone else's brain onto someone else's body, the person whose brain it is going to, you know, be the identity. It's probably not going to be that simple. And a lot of these hypothetical discussions in the philosophical world is full of them. They're interesting, but often they presuppose what kind of result is going to take place from some purely hypothetical thing that whose outcome we really know nothing about. So I think, yeah, science has pushed the boundaries of medicine by, in the first place, suggesting that, showing that, well, stopping the heart doesn't mean death. And it turns out, well, stopping of brain waves don't seem to, you know, entirely mean death either. But where it's going to go further than that, you know, it becomes very speculative very fast. That's all I would like to say about that.
Let me, in the time that we have left, and it's been a great chat. I don't know how it's going to be received by listeners, because we've kind of bounced all over the place and engaged in some inside baseball. But that's kind of the nature of these things. If you're going to have just a very plain vanilla conversation, it probably wouldn't be interesting to us, you know. So another part of the process that is this show is Skeptico. Is this idea of conspiracy. And it's not because I like conspiracies. I was never even aware of the idea of any kind of the role the conspiracy played, except in following the data, following the scientific data. And why are they presenting it like this? And why are they seem to be know one thing and say something else? And I think, Richard, some of your work has become extremely popular among people who would consider themselves conspiratorial, because it's just the nature of, again, I don't think you're a conspiracy guy per se or a conspiracy theorist. Far from it. You've just followed the data where it leads. And some of the things you've discovered, people find shattering of their existing belief systems. And I want to talk about a couple of those, because there's a couple that I think are really interesting to kind of just get out there. One is, again, and if I got this wrong, you know, you tell me, but from your very excellent How God Became God best-selling book, one of the points you make is this idea that we have about the devil, Satan, the bad guy, whoever you want to characterize him, in the Old Testament and before the Old Testament, we can pretty much go back and trace that as an invention that seems to pop up in these books kind of out of thin air. Did I get that wrong? Or do you want to elaborate that on that a little bit? Because I think that's really, really significant for the way a lot of people are processing that history.
Yeah. Well, to give a very simple or simplistic answer, Judaism before the sack of the first temple in 586 BC doesn't really seem to have very much of a concept of a devil.
And Yahweh is kind of playing both sides. Yahweh's the good guy and Yahweh's the bad guy, right? I mean,
it's radical monotheism. I make peace and create evil. That's from the book of Isaiah. I, the Lord, do all these things. After the exile, the Babylonian exile in the 6th century BC, this concept of Satan comes in. Now, religious scholars generally say, and maybe the evidence isn't really quite so strong for this as it might be, but that this concept of the devil was introduced into Judaism from Zoroastrianism, because they were living in the Persian Empire, and Zoroastrianism was very dualistic with a dark figure called Ahriman. So that is the, you know, standard scholarly answer. I don't see any particular reason to doubt it. And later on, this devil starts to become more and more prominent. Satan, in the book of Job, which is written probably in the 6th century BC, nobody really knows, Satan is not really God's enemy. Satan goes up to heaven to pay God a visit. Hey, Satan, how's it going? What have you been up to? Well, I've been walking around up the earth. And hey, that Job guy of mine, he's a pretty great guy, huh? Oh, yeah. Well, if you poke him a little, he won't be so great. That's how the book of Job starts. There's certainly no cosmic opposition in the early days of Judaism. And this has survived in Jewish mysticism to this day. The angels are not necessarily evil, but they're not necessarily friends of humans. Like accusing figures, like Satan. So later on, it mutated yet further into the, you know, Christian devil that we know and I suppose love.
Well, you know, and there's an interesting tie back here to something that Auntie was saying earlier in the show about the distinction between Christ consciousness and Jesus. And, you know, because in this work that you've done, this incredible body of work in pulling apart, examining, and carefully analyzing, again, we're talking to a guy who's Harvard educated, Oxford educated, a true scholar and capable of doing this work. When you go look at the text, it's telling us a different story than what the mystics are experiencing in some cases. And to that end, you know, how do you square the idea of what you just said about Satan, about the devil, about evil, with the experience that so many people have of the reality of that? And is it possible that since this is all kind of a thought form thing, as we were talking about, when we were talking about the idiosyncratic nature of all of this and how it, at some level we're all making all this up in our heads, but at the same time as we make up the same thing, we seem to live that same thing. I mean, have you given any thought to how we pull apart the thought form understanding of things versus the spiritual reality? Again, reality is a tricky word, of things. Do you get what I'm driving at there?
Yeah, and it's a very long and complex answer. But, you know, to give a short answer to part of it, I think the thought form concept that you mentioned is important because human thought has power. It has power. It enables you to build bridges and blow up other people and all sorts of things like that. But the thought itself has a kind of power. If a lot of people have the same thought, it's power squared. And in the occult literature, this is called an egregore, which is what I just said. It's a collectively generated thought form that appears to have a quasi-independent existence. If you don't want to use the example of the devil, how about Santa Claus? It's more or less the same thing. Does Santa Claus exist? No, not really. But, you know, on the other hand, Santa Claus does exist in people's minds. You know, I think the devil does exist in people's minds. Then, you know, there's a larger problem, which is, of course, the problem of evil and who is to blame for it. And that's, Well, that's a really big topic. We could go into it or not, you know, as you prefer.
Antti, do you have anything to maybe add to that, or in particular how it might relate to your understanding of P.E.'s work? How much of that is, because it also relates to his time in history, and that, you know, I think if we take Richard's idea of thought forms mattering, making a difference, then I think that also explains why we all kind of move in lockstep with our times to a certain extent, because we are embedded in a culture, we are embedded in a common cultural motif, you know, from one time or another.
Well, I take a lead about that devil issue, not devil himself or herself, whatever that is, but about a negative near-death experiences, which are even hellish. As when you take a look at the book, there's a chapter about these afterlife stages, which are hellish in nature. And P.E. tells in his own experience that there are no devils in hell. There are just human beings who have evil thoughts and habits. And then, as Richard mentioned, there are some kind of thought forms which are formed by people producing those evil and murderers and that kind of thoughts. And they have so much power that they exist there for some time. And if a person has kind of affinity harboring those negative feelings and thoughts throughout the life, or at least to some extent, then it might be that this is somehow attracting to these lower levels of afterlife. And I find it interesting that negative near-death experiences, they tend to reveal that these stages are felt by people who go briefly to the other side, so to speak. And of course, usually they don't go to hell as such, but they are allowed to see or hear something quite near. That's what I gather when I read some books about that issue. But it seems to cohere with, for instance, B.E. and other theosophical sources are telling about it. So I'm not sure if it answers anything about this issue of the issue of evil or devil, but it's an interesting point to be made that it's human beings who are producing that evil in those afterlife stages, but it's only temporary. There is no such thing as permanent hell. I'm sorry that I dragged this discussion back into the book, but I'm not a Bible scholar at all, so I'm just reading Bart Ehrman and some other sources to know what they are saying about the scholarship of Bible, so I can't really make any comment about that, but this is what I wanted to say.
Yes, no, that's very good. I kind of tend to agree with you that as above, so below, and turning that around works too, as below, so above. I mean, we don't have to look very far to imagine how far evil can go in the realms beyond this world, right? I mean, we see it all around us. So if there's any kind of extension of that into these other realms, hell yes, there's evil.
Indeed.
Yeah. I mean, I would guess just sort of sum up with a line from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, know these things to be thine own thought forms, you know, as the deceased person is going through the both positive and negative aspects of the after-death state.
Awesome. Well, perhaps we'll just leave it there, because we could go on and on and on. Such a great, interesting conversation. Again, our guests have been Dr. Antti Savanian from Finland, who's just written this new book, From Death to Rebirth. Also, Richard Smoley, who's, you can check out his excellent website. We'll have a link to it. And be sure to check out his latest book, How God Became God. Thank you so much to both of you for joining me today on Skeptico.
So it's free. It's an ebook, and there will be an audio version of it as well. So anybody can read it and download it, no strings attached. We are not interested in selling anything or attaching people to any groups or anything like that. Read it if you like it, and if you don't, that's fine as well.
That's great. And I'll also include that in the introduction very early on. So don't worry, I'll mention that. And Richard, I'm sorry, tell folks some more, because I just kind of blew past this. Tell folks more about, they'd be very interested, I'm sure, in hearing about what you're working on, what's up with you, where they can find out more about what you're up to these days.
Thank you. I want to, first of all, I want to thank you very, very much for your extremely kind and supportive words about my work. I'm really very grateful for that. Well, my website is innerchristianity, I-N-N-E-R, christianity.com, which has a description about me, my books, and so on. I'm editor of Quest, which is the Journal of the Theosophical Society in America. And that is, most of its contents are online, at least for back issues, so people can have access to that readily. As I say, my latest book is How God Became God, What Scholars Are Really Saying About God and the Bible. And what that is essentially attempt to present, just a basic street level guide to, well, you've heard part of the Bible is literally true. Part of it isn't. What parts are, what parts aren't. And that is, attempt to digest scholarly opinion to a greater or lesser extent. Of course, being the author, I have my own opinions and certainly insert those as well. But I think it's a fascinating topic and, I find it continuously absorbing. So in any case, that's a little bit about me. I really, really do appreciate your time and your interest. This has been a delightful conversation.
Well, it certainly has for me, and I thank both of you very much.
And it's been kind of a dream come true because I'm an avid skeptic listener, so being part of the show is just wonderful, and to talk about these topics, amazing. Thank you so much, Alex and Richard. I really appreciate your work and your contribution to this project, and it was so nice to talk to you both. Thanks.
Thanks again for Antti and Richard for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess the one question I tee up from this interview is, what does await us after we die? That's a huge question, but it's the question of this interview, so let's toss it around. Is there really a there to even explore? Is it all thought form created by what we think it's going to be? Or is there a reality out there that we must face? Let me know your thoughts. Of course, the place to do it is, well, any way you want. You can do it through the Skeptico forum at skeptiko.com. You can reach me on Facebook or drop me an email or even on Twitter. I'm starting to slowly, eventually move over to Twitter a little bit and try and dabble in that. So if you want to try and reach me over there, that's fine as well. Any way you connect with me will be fine with me. I'd love to connect and hear what you think about the show. Well, I have a number of episodes coming up. I also am trying to do more video. I don't know how that's going to go. It's kind of a lot more work, but I'm trying to figure out a way to do it that's manageable. But I will be putting out more YouTube videos related to the interviews that I do on Skeptico. So look for that if you're interested as well. All right, enough for today. Until next time, take care and bye for now.